of the Gaonim by talking about where the Jewish communities were living. Basically, we said around the Mediterranean. We talked about the origins of some of the different communities, the major centers, really being Eretz Yisrael is still strong at that point. Babel, the major center, and then Rome and the Italian provinces overall. We said those seem to be the major ones, and then we talked about the way that it worked going around the Mediterranean. The last bit from last time, we had said that the Gemara is canonized by the start of the 6th century CE, talk about Talmud Bavli, separate from Talmud Yerushalmi. And we said that there's this period after the conclusion of the Talmud Bavli, which is known as the period of the Savo Ra'im, as defined by Rav Shri Ragon in his letter, which we saw last time. We said that the Savo Ra'im do a degree of editing of the Gemara, and there are passages which Rav Shri Ragon and others claim are actually in our Gemara, which are from the Savo Ra'im. And the last bit that was left from that discussion before we move on to the Reish Galusa and the Gaon is that relations between the Jews and the Sasanian government are rocky at this point. And because there was some question of what exactly is the difference between Persians and Parthians and so on, so I gave you on the list, on the sheet, a list. The Achaemenid Persians are the ones who we're most familiar with. When we think of Persians, that's who we're usually thinking of. They're the ones who destroyed, really, the Babylonian Empire. That's Cyrus the Great in the year 550 before the Common Era. That's when he becomes king. 539 is when he defeats the Babylonians, and that's when he tells the Jews, you can come back for what becomes the second Beis HaMikdash. And the Achaemenid Persians are in control of that region until Alexander the Great. So those are your Persians. Then the Greeks knock out the Persians thanks to Alexander, and that you see on here, 4th century before the Common Era, till the 3rd century before the Common Era. They were a powerful empire beyond that. I mean, Hanukkah doesn't take place then. Hanukkah is another 100 years after that. But at that point, the Parthians are now in control. The Parthians, they sound a lot like the Persians, but they're from a different part of Persia. But they're local, as opposed to the Greeks who are coming in from elsewhere. So the Parthians are 3rd century before the Common Era, all the way until 3rd century Common Era, and then the Sasanians take over. And the Sasanians are the ones who close the yeshivos. They close the major yeshivos of Babel, reopen them in the year 589, and according to Rav Shri Ragon, that's the start of the period of the Gaonim, who are the heads of those yeshivos. Clear? Sorry? So I don't know. It's not a tremendously long time. We're not talking about something that's like a century of closure. But it's some period of time. I don't remember anymore what we're talking about in terms of just how long.
It's closed.
Correct. And then the Sasanians are in power until the Muslims come along in the 7th century, and then you get a whole series of caliphates that we may have talked about that a little bit. Okay. So already during the time of the Gemara, the Jews in Babel developed semi-autonomous self-government, which, whether it's because we're Jews or whether it's because we're human beings, comes with a full bureaucracy of officials who are in charge of this semi-autonomous self-government. And the head of that bureaucracy is the Reish Galusa. The usual translation of the term Reish Galusa is exilarch, right? Because Reish Galusa, the head of the Jews in exile, exilarch. The job of the Reish Galusa is fundamentally twofold. Number one, to represent the Jews before whatever king, sultan, whoever is in charge, and to collect taxes and administer justice internally. So money and justice internally, and speaking to the exilarch, who generally speaking wants, speaking to the king, who generally wants the money part of it. The Reish Galusa's authority came from being a descendant of David HaMelech, as well as being close with the foreign government. more than one person, more than one family could claim descent from David, but there's only one Reish Galusa, and that's the one who the local government, you know, recognizes as the Reish Galusa. They had inauguration ceremony. It was a thing in order to, you know, to broadcast, you know, this is our leader, right? If you read, this is not a Reish Galusa, but just in parallel, if you read the Book of Maccabees, right? Are people, if you're cold, I can override the, okay. The Book of Maccabees gives you what happened with the Hashmonaim after Hanukkah. And you find that they became increasingly Hellenized, and they had these kinds of ceremonies that really emulated the Greek ceremonies for coronating new kings. You seem surprised about the whole Hellenization.
It went back to the Hellenization thing.
Yeah,
that we just,
it's a thing.
That we just won that we just fought a war over.
Not just.
I mean, yeah, it took a couple of generations, but not too many. Now Ramban writes about this. He's very critical of the Hashmonaim because of this. Abarbanel on Sefer Daniel talks about it. So so that's your Reish Galusa, and from the inception of the position, already during the time of the Gemara, the Reish Galusa has ties with the halachic leadership, but those ties are not always positive. Two different Gemaras illustrate this. If you take a look at source number one, this is Maseches Erevin. Hahu Abvarnika, Dehavale L'Reish Galusa Bebustine. The Reish Galusa, the exilarch, had an Abvarnika, some kind of a shady area to rest, you know, to enjoy being outdoors a little bit, in his orchard. Amar Leila Rav Huna Bar Chinina. So he says to Rav Huna Bar Chinina, Le'aved Mar Takanta, De'lamachar Nochal Nahama Hasam. Set this up so that we're going to have bread there tomorrow. What does he need? Sorry? An Erev. Right, he needs an Erev. So Azal Avad Kana Kana Pachas Mishlosha. So he sets it up with reeds, less than three tefach between each one, employing the principle of lavud, and now you have a wall around it. Azal Rava Shalfinhu. Rava takes the thing apart. He says, "This is wrong. This is being done improperly." And Shalfinhu means he. What I put in the brackets, that's funny. I put in the brackets to prevent rebuilding. That's actually the next line. That belongs after that. Also, Rav Papa and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua Naktinhu Mi Basrei. Rav Papa and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua are worried, so you took them down, but somebody else is going to put them back up. So they actually collected all the reeds and took them away so that nobody should do it. Kari alayu reish galusa chachamim hema lahara ulehitiv lo yada'u. He quotes a pasuk from Yirmiyahu saying, sure, they know how to do bad, but they don't know how to do right. I just wanted an Eruv. You know, they didn't put up an Eruv, they put up an Eruv, but they actually took away the materials. They didn't come up with a better way to do it. These rabbis always say no. That was the Reish Galusa's response. But it shows you a Reish Galusa who is loyal to Halacha. He's a little frustrated, but fundamentally he asked for the Erev in the first place. That's one side. The other side is from this Gemara in Sanhedrin in source number 2. Rabba Bar Rav Huna, ki avaminsi bahade de Reish Galusa. When Rabba Bar Rav Huna used to get into fights with the house of the exilarch, Amar, he said, lav minaychu nakitna reshusa. I don't depend on you for my authority. Nakitna reshusa me abba mari. My permission to rule comes from Rav Huna, my father and mentor. Va'aba Mari me Rav. And my father got it from Rav, v'Rav me Rabbi Chia, and Rabbi Chia me Rebbe. I don't depend on the Reish Galusa to lead the Jewish community, to paskin for the Jewish community. That shows you some of the strife between them. This was, in context, this Gemara in Sanhedrin, if you remember the beginning of Sanhedrin, is about the authority of a dayan and the whole concept of smicha. So, bless you. So what he's saying is that we normally say that a dayan who has smicha is indemnified from liability if he makes a mistake. So he said, I don't need the Reish Galusa for that. I got the authority from my father, and that's good enough. I don't need the Reish Galusa. So the Reish Galusa It's unclear to me where he is based during the period of the Gemara, whether he's Sura, Pumbedisa, Masamachthio, these different communities which we enumerated last time. But what we do know is that in the year 750, so you're now well into the Muslim period, the Abbasids established a caliphate with an administrative center in Baghdad. And the Reish Galusa relocated to Baghdad. Sometime second half of the 8th century, Baghdad becomes the center, and that's where it's going to be, basically, for most of the Gaonic period, is going to be the Reish Galusa is centered in Baghdad, while the Gaonim are based in Sura and Pumbedisa. That tends to be how it works, in Bavel. That's Reish Galusa. Starting at the end of the 6th century, like we've said, Rav Shvira Gaon credits it to the year 589, we have a Gaon. The yeshivos that were under Sasanian control most directly are, like we said, Sura and Pumbedisa in Bavel. You also have a yeshiva in Israel, which is not under the Sasanians, right? That's formerly the Roman Empire. I think at this point it's probably Byzantine. I didn't look that up, but I assume it's Byzantine at this point, as well as in what is today Tunisia, right? This is the yeshiva we mentioned last time, which is Kairouan, is the name of the community. Kairouan is not at the level of the other yeshivos, right? It's not, I mean, who am I to say that? But they're not. They're very reliant, it seems, from things that we'll get to eventually. They're reliant on and linked to the yeshiva in Israel. So it becomes sort of, you've got Kairouan and you've got Israel on one side, and then you have the yeshivas of Bavel on the other, and we'll see repercussions of that. In terms of the title of Gaon, it's not entirely clear when it actually started, or for that matter, what it meant. Rav Shvira Gaon, even as he says, the Gaonim start in the year 589 when the yeshivas reopen, we do know that there are people before that who, in his letter, he identifies as Gaon. So clearly it's not as simple and straightforward as saying, well, the yeshiva's open and the head of the yeshiva is titled the Gaon. The term Gaon itself has to mean power or greatness, right? That's what it means. When we call someone a Baal Gaiva, it's because they're claiming to be great. But Gaava, like in Hadaras Vamuna, Hagava veHagadula just means power. That's really what it refers to. So either this means a person of power, or alternatively, the yeshiva was called Gaon Yaakov. They actually named the yeshiva Gaon Yaakov, and so the head of the yeshiva was known as the Gaon.
The yeshiva where?
So each of these yeshivas, Sura Pumbedisa primarily, but yeah. So yes, yeah, I'm going to just turn up the heat a little bit.
I mean, I'm pretending that it's actually going to be effective, but it's important to have dreams and aspirations. Just someone remind me afterwards to be said.
Someone said, we don't want to be heating Franklin Square. So... The Gaonim, in their capacity as head of the yeshiva, are most directly responsible for the yeshiva itself. Being responsible for the yeshiva itself is exactly what you would think. It means that they raise funds in order to be able to support the yeshiva. They gave shiurim in the yeshiva. They also gave shiurim in the community more broadly. And we'll see how that flows over time. The Gaonim were resources for the communities that relied on them for leadership. They wrote responsa to Jews everywhere on matters great and small. A lot of the literature that we have now comes from the Cairo Geniza, where they've discovered so many letters from the Gaonim, and they've been published, and they continue to be published. It's really remarkable, because I remember when I was in yeshiva, like, you had very little available in terms of what the Gaonim wrote. There was a set of Sfarim called the Otzer Gaonim that they had in yeshiva. And that was more or less what you had. And they've just, they continue to publish volumes of responsa from the Gaonim. It gives you much, much better insight into them. They answered major things, like we talked about last time, the letter of Rav Shvira Gaon, where you have an entire community that writes to them and says, help, we don't understand Masorah. or Rav Amram Gaon, who we're going to get to, God willing, who the Jews, I think they're in Spain, if I remember correctly, send to him saying, you know, we could use a sitter. They didn't have siddurim. So he sends them a sitter to, you know, communities where they just, you know, random person sends a question to the Gaon about how to do Erev Tchumen. Or one of my favorites, there's a letter, I'm forgetting now which Gaon answers this question, but this somebody who sends a message saying, we have somebody in our shul who on Yom Kippur brings in a cushion. Is it okay for him to be sitting on a cushion while everybody else is just like sitting on the floor? And so he answers it both in terms of whether cushions are allowed on Yom Kippur, are seating cushions okay, and is it okay that this person is sitting, you know, in this nice way while everybody else is, you know, lower than them. Like, questions that just, you know, hey, we need answers, so let's write away to the Gaon. They also wrote compositions, which became fundamental ways that our Masorah is taught. And that's something we need to discuss, is why they decided to change their style. Because, as we said last time, Torah Shebaal Peh is Torah Shebaal Peh. The decision to write down and publish the Gemara is a big deal. You had some people who wrote Megillat Sdarim, you know, scrolls which they specifically put away and hid with halacha in them. You had some people who were kosvei brachos, who wrote down tefillos, but they were criticized in the Gemara for doing so. And here you will get people who will actually record for posterity and publish works of halacha. So we're going to start with Rav Achoy and his she'iltos. That'll be the first one that we're going to end up seeing. But the Seder of Amram Gaon, the Seder that he gives, Igeres Rav Shira Gaon, the Halachos Gedolos, which may be the earliest halachic work that we have as a straight work of recording halacha, Emunos Videos, Rav Sadia Gaon's work of philosophy, HaEgron, the first Hebrew dictionary, which is not what Rehov Agron in Israel is named for. That's actually somebody named Agron. That caused me a great deal of confusion. And these chuvos. There are more that we'll see. The period runs until, generally speaking, the 11th century. We're going to need to talk more about when exactly it ends, because there's this fellow named Shmuel ben Ali in the time of the Rambam who says, I'm a Gaon. So not everybody got the memo about the Gaonic period ending. There is, as we said, some tension between the Gaon and the Reish Galusa. Generally speaking, religion trumped politics. So in terms of the general population, people sided with the Gaon when there was a dispute between the Gaon and the Reish Galusa, which happened with embarrassing frequency. We'll see, for example, Rav Sadia Gaon, and he ends up being deposed by the Reish Galusa at one point over a financial matter where Rav Sadia Gaon wasn't willing to play along with the Reish Galusa.
Was there a change between the time of the Gemara where there was still a tension and then in the Gaonic period? Was there a difference in that, or is it really just the same?
I think it's the same. It's just playing out in each generation, right. You know, with nuances. But yeah, in the 10th century, there's a controversy between the Reish Galusa, whose name was Mar Ukva, not the Mar Ukva of the Gemara, obviously, and the Gaon of Pumbedisa, and it actually leads to the Reish Galusa being forced into exile, which, when you think about it, where do you go when you're already the Reish Galusa and you're in exile?
Because it seems like in the Gemara, the Reish Galusa tend to come out on top of. No?
I don't know if I'd say always. No. I mean, there were certain issues for which he was needed. And you didn't have a true Gaon. You had, you know, at that point you're dealing with Amorim. It's a little bit of a different dynamic.
The Gaon of the time.
Yeah, so that may have affected the dynamic. But I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. One last major force that we need to know about, and we're going to come back to them in greater depth when they come up later, but you can't really talk about this period without introducing them, are the Karaites. Little bit of background on their history. The traditional view of Karaites is that they were a sect invented by a man by the name of Anan. And the way the story goes is that Anan was a Jew who was heretical in terms of his rejection of rabbinic authority. And the Muslims did not like heresy, whether it was heresy against Islam or heresy against Judaism. And so he was set to be executed. And somebody gave him advice and said to him, you know, if you explain that you're not a heretic, you're a different religion, then you'll be okay. So he says, I am actually the true Jew. My version of things is accurate. These rabbis have come along and they have warped Judaism. He's not the only one in history to try this, but he does it and he is effective and ends up with this new sect called the Karaites. That's the traditional view of where this comes from, is this fellow Anan. The Karaites, unsurprisingly, don't think that that's where they come from. The Karaite view is that they come from the Sadducees, right? The Sadducees are the aristocracy and the Kohanim during the end of the second Beis Hamikdash. They also challenge rabbinic authority. And the Karaites said, that's where we come from. The Sadducees never disappeared. We are their heirs, just, you know, 500 years later. The Tzugim. We also have the Bothusians, the Baitusim, but I'm not going into nuances between them. They tend to get lumped together. So the way the Karaites tell the story is that the rabbis ganged up on Anan and tried to get him killed, and that this fellow Anan, what his major crime was that he rejected... Sorry, no. First of all, Anan was supposed to be, according to the Karaites, the Reish Galusa. He rejected the position of the Reish Galusa because he did not want to work within this whole power structure and went off on his own road. They were influenced by some Islamic sects. They believed in a limited human role in interpreting law, not no human role. The Karaites, even though their name, Karaite, comes from Kara, the text, that they're, you know, text-driven, they do accept some human role in it. They just think that the rabbis have it wrong. Some of their methods of interpreting psukim in the Torah actually match Muslim methods of interpretation. They emphasize certain Jewish practices that had Muslim parallels, such as washing before prayer. Bowing during prayer is a very big deal for the Karaites. But yes, they believed in limited rabbinic authority. Most famously, they don't have Hanukkah, they don't have Purim. I don't know if they substitute some other stat holiday to, you know, get off from school. They set their calendar by lunar observation. They did not believe in playing with the calendar, meaning if you know those classic passages in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah where they say that the Beis Din is entitled to shift Rosh Chodesh, even if it's not going to match the moon, in order to get the results that we need so that Yom Kippur shouldn't be on a Friday or a Sunday, things like that. The Karaites said you're not allowed to do that. That figures very powerfully in those stories that you're familiar with Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, where Rabban Gamliel says, well, the calendar is this way, and Rabbi Yeshua says, no, it's not. Like that, this is really an issue, the question of the authority of the Beis Din to play with the calendar. And it works both ways, in the sense that on the one hand, it says, well, we have the power to do it, and we should demonstrate we have the power to do it. On the other hand, by doing it and having a situation in which the world looks at the moon and says, that's not in sync with what you're declaring Rosh Chodesh, you're playing into their hands. They're going to say, look at these rabbis, look what they've done to what was supposed to be a lunar calendar. They did not believe in a lot of the oral traditions that we have in halacha. Bittul b'shishim, right? The idea that meat and dairy, right? If you have a ratio of 60 to 1, you nullify something in a mixture. They didn't do that. That's not part of what they did. I say did, past tense. There are people who claim to be Karaites to this day. They're not a huge community, but they do exist in Israel as well as in the U.S.
So wait, they did not follow Dinei Rabbanan, but they also did not follow Torah Shebaal Peh completely or partly?
They weren't believers. They believed that our Torah Shebaal Peh has
it
been
was
polluted
by the
rabbi. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
They were not on board with it. That's correct. So that's in terms of the just the, you know, sort of introduction to this period. Let's start a little bit with Rabbi Choy, if that's okay. Okay, it's a minute to nine, so we still have about 10 minutes. We're good. Okay. So, Rav Achoy, I called him on your sheet Rav Achoy Gaon. As we're going to find out, he actually was not a Gaon. Everyone calls him that. They say, if you look at your standard issue volume of Shildos, it says, often it'll say, Shildos Rav Achoy Gaon. He actually was Dafka not a Gaon, but we'll talk about that. He was known as Rav Acha from Shabcha. He lived in Pumbedisa until he made Aliyah, and he goes off to Israel. I use him as the first Gaon, or whatever we'll call him, because some actually claim that he was among the Savoroi, that he's before the period of the Gaonim. He is best known for writing what's called the Shildos, which we're going to talk about. And he's relevant to this day, both in terms of his Torah, meaning the Shiltos is a halachic work that gets quoted, and also his story is fascinating. So, first...
So the fact that it's a Shiltos Rav Achoy Gaon, that was attributed to someone else just called him that?
Yeah, there were people who called him Gaon because he lived in that period, but he was never the head of a yeshiva, as we'll see. Fascinating story.
But speaking of period, he didn't live in the time of Savarum.
So that's the question. These are two different questions. One is, was he actually the head of Yeshiva if he was in the period of the Gaonim? And the answer is no. And the other is, did he even live during the period of the Gaonim? Or was he actually pre-Gaonim during the period of the Savarim? So the dominant view is no, he did not. But it's a view brought in Tosfos, which we're going to see. There is a school of thought that he lived during the period of the Savaroim, brought forth by none other than the Rashbam. The Rashbam, grandson of Rashi, thinks so. What happens is, there are a couple of times in the Gemara where Rav Achoy shows up, and the statement that Rav Achoy makes is introduced by an odd verb. An odd verb, instead of saying something like Omar, we get, in one case you'll see here, Parich, when he asks a question. Or in another case, you've got Pashit when he's answering or explaining something in another Gemara, in source number 4. So if you look at this Tosfos, in source number 3, when the Gemara has a question from Rav Achoy, and it says, Parich Rav Achoy. So the Gemara says, B'chol makom l'shono mishuna. When Rav Achoy shows up in the Gemara, he has unusual language. K'da'ashkhan b'reish k'suvos, like we find in the beginning of k'suvos, Pashit Rav Achoy, which is what we're going to quote in number 4. Umitoch kach haya omer Rabbeinu Shmuel. Because of this, Rabbeinu Shmuel, who is the Rashbam, right, he said, Dehu Rav Achoy sha'asa hasheiltos, that this Rav Achoy who's being mentioned in the Gemara is actually the Rav Achoy who wrote the sheiltos, shahaya mi Rabbanan Savoroi debasa Ravina v'Ravashi. He was from the Savoroim who were after Ravina and Ravashi. Dehosif hora. He added halachic rulings to the Gemara. And his words were included at the end of the Gemara. It doesn't mean the physical end of the Gemara, but it means the end of the period of the Gemara. Umihu, b'ahid k'suvos ashkach Rav Ashi demayri basrei. However, in the discussion in k'suvos, you find Rav Ashi after him. Satosus quotes the Rashbam, saying that, yes, this is somebody who's in the Savoraic period, and he wrote the Sheiltos. But then you have that little note at the end of Tosfos saying, this is difficult, because if he is this later Rav Achoy, how did Rav Ashi answer him? Rav Ashi, by definition, is still the time of the Gemara. Ravina and Rav Ashi are the ones who close the Gemara. So you get a skepticism about it. I should note, this Rav Achoy, who's in this Tosfos, is Rav Achoy from a place called Bechisim, which is not Shabcha, where Rav Shria Gaon says that Rav Achoy was, and as the Rambam said, Rav Achoy was. So maybe there are two different Rav Achoys who we're talking about. It could be. This is Rav Achoy number 1, and that's Rav Achoy number 2.
In Zvachim, he comes out as a man to Amr din the Maskana. He's the last.
So he's actually asking a question.
Oh,
there.
So
he's challenging. But then, we don't get a name of somebody responding.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Does anyone respond?
I don't remember the sugya, but it was.
If anyone responds, yeah, it's problematic.
Yeah, so I don't think so. Unless it's an anonymous Savaroi.
Right.
So that's an answer to Rashbam. They quote you Rashbam and say, but we don't know what Rashbam is going to do with the fact that you have Ravashi brought to answer it. We don't know what Rashbam's answer is. This is one of the Bali Atosos who's recording what Rashbam said.
Right, but if Ravashi did come in the Gemara after Rav Achoy,
then it sounds like it can't be, like what Rashbam says.
It can't be a Savaroy.
Yeah.
It's a fashion.
Right. Yes. No, but he's asking about what happens in the Zvachim, in the Ksuba. No, in the
Ksuba's Gemara is, this is where it's talking.
Right, like, right. The Ksuba's one is the one where Ravashi is in the discussion after him.
Right, but Tosfos is commenting on Paruch HaRachai.
Yeah. So when you look in Tosfos, in source number 4, Tosfos in the Sugya and Ksuvos, Pashit Ravachoi, Ravachoi, you know, answered, the word Pashit is used, Lo Kamo Shapirish Rashbam. He says, not like Rashbam, and I skipped bringing you again what Rashbam said, because you already saw it. Sherei Kan Rav Ashi Onal Dvarav. He says, look, Rav Ashi is answering him. How can that be that he will be later than Rav Ashi? Ela Omer Rabbeinu Tam Shehu Amora. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, this Rav Achoy who we have here is a regular Amora named Rav Achoy. V'chol Amora haya tofes l'shono. He says, it's not odd for an Amora to have his own verbs. Amoraim did that. Kamo Megadev Ba Rabbi Avahu. Tahi Ba Rabbi Yochanan. Layit Ale Abaye. You find throughout the Gemara that Amoraim have unique words. Not all of them, not every time. But there are a fair number of times where it's Amar Abaye, or Abaye Omar if he's responding. But you shouldn't extrapolate from this unique word to say that this is that this is late. It's not necessarily so. Rabbeinu Tam does not agree. Sefer Hayashar, which is a separate work of Rabbeinu Tam, he also brings that he believes that it's not true, that it's not so. There's more to say on it. The Netziv has a commentary to the She'iltos, which we're going to get to and quote. Called the Pesach HaEmek, and he has a longer discussion about this business of Parich and all of that. But when giving the shiur, I go back and forth between wanting to bring extra sources on a fine point like this and wanting to get the overview, because otherwise we're never going to get out of that century. And we have 14 centuries to see. The general assumption regarding when Rav Achoy of the She'iltos lived is like Rabbeinu Tam. That She'iltos Rav Achoy is the time of the Gaonim. The year that I've usually seen for him is that he's born approximately the year 680, and he lives until either 752 or 762. We know that he makes Aliyah sometime after the year 750, and you'll see how we know that, but that's something we can fix. He learned in Masamachsia under Mar Shmuel Reish Kala. That's reported in a sefer called Sefer HaEshkol, which is a sefer from the Rishonim that tries to give some of this chronology of who was when and where. There's some debate about some of the history in it. Surprise. But that's what Sefer HaEshkol said. And he's considered authoritative during the period of the Gaonim. So the Netziv notes that the Baha Halachos Gedolos, quotes the She'iltos. So you have one Sefer of the Gaonim quoting another Sefer of the Gaonim. We have to discuss who the Baal Halachos Gedolos was eventually, because that's not clear. But he is a Gaon, that we know. And he's quoted in Shuvos of the Gaonim. You find responsa of the Gaonim where they will quote the She'iltos. So, yeah, he's a major authority, already back then. And then the Rishonim quote him heavily. So Rashi on the Gemara will quote the She'iltos. The Aruch, Rav Nosson Baal HaAruch, will quote the She'iltos. Aramaic. Oh, so what does it come from? We'll get to when we talk about the Sefer, but basically She'ilta is the way he introduces each of his notes. She'ilta meaning a question. It's in the format of a question and then a whole discussion on that question. Not quite a tshuva, as we'll see. We're going to see examples of it. But the She'ilta is just the plural of She'ilta, because he called each one of his comments. So we're going to talk about that. That will be part of the that will be part of the discussion. So I think what we'll do is we'll start next time by talking about who the Rishonim Paskin like when you have Rav Achoy versus the Bahag, who is another of these major halachic authorities in the Gaonim. So who's dominant? Who gets followed? The Netziv has what to say about that. And we're going to talk about him leaving and going off to Eretz Yisrael and how he did not become a Gaon. And then we'll talk about the She'iltos itself as a sefer. So that'll be God willing, next Sunday. I assume next Sunday works. Yeah, next Sunday. It'll be Hanukkah, but
yeah.
I think we're still good with learning Torah on Hanukkah. I think that was the point. So, okay.